All right, let's continue our study of Exodus chapter 22 by just reading some scripture first. We're going to start at verse 18. We're going to read to the end of the chapter. Exodus chapter 22. If you've got a complete Jewish Bible, we're going to start on page 85. Exodus chapter 22, starting at verse 18. It can be numbered a little bit differently in your Bible, depending on what you're using. And we'll go ahead and start here. You are not to permit a sorceress to live. Whoever has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. Anyone who practices to any sacrifices to any god other than Adonai alone is to be completely destroyed. You must neither wrong nor oppress a foreigner living among you, for you yourselves were foreigners in the land of Egypt. You are not to abuse any widow or orphan. If you do abuse them in any way and they cry to me, I will certainly heed their cry. My anger will burn. I will kill you with the sword. Your own wives will be widows, your own children fatherless. If you loan money to one of my people who is poor, you are not to deal with him as you would a creditor. You are not to charge him interest. If you take your neighbor's coat as collateral, you are to restore it to him by sundown because it's his only garment. He needs it to wrap his body. What else does he have in which to sleep? Moreover, if he cries out to me, I'll listen, because I am compassionate. You are not to curse God. You are not to curse a leader of your people. You are not to delay offering from your harvest or grain, olive oil or wine. The firstborn of your sheep, firstborn of your sons you are to give to me. You are to do the same with your oxen and your sheep. It is to stay with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you are to give it to me. You are to be my specially separated people. Therefore, you are not to eat any flesh torn by wild animals in the countryside. Rather, throw it out for the dogs. Well, as quickly and matter-of-factly that we're told of these acts that must immediately bring death upon the offender. Beginning in verse 21, we get this series of instructions reflecting God's mercy and compassion, especially upon some particularly vulnerable social groups. Israel is told they are to welcome and respect the ger, G-E-R, ger, which is Hebrew for strangers, foreigners, non-Hebrews, Gentiles, who come to live with them. Now, what this is actually contemplating is a foreigner, a Gentile, becoming a member of Israel. This instruction will be built upon as we move forward in the law of Moses, eventually making it clear just how a foreigner can become a Hebrew, how they are to be considered first-class citizens, no higher nor lower in status than a natural-born Hebrew. This concept is central to Gentile Christianity because the spiritual manifestation of this instruction is that Gentiles can become spiritual Israelites, if you would, by becoming spiritual seed of Abraham, and thus being included in Israel's covenants. Now remember, even the so-called covenant of Christ, which Christians call the new covenant, who was that given to? Israel. Christ then said that by means of faith, Gentiles, foreigners, ger, could partake of this covenant and all the other covenants given to Israel. Widows and orphans are to be treated kindly with compassion. In fact, God emphatically states that he will become greatly angry with those who abuse or take advantage of such helpless women and children, and there will be severe consequences. The loaning of money to a poor person is now considered, and that poor person is to be treated with mercy and fairness because the desperate can be easily exploited. No interest is to be charged. And if that poor person offers his cloak, his coat, as security for the money, it must be given back to him in the evening So he's not cold. The salma, which is Hebrew for a garment like a cloak, was a piece of cloth that wrapped around the body, and it was used as both clothing and a blanket. Often this was a poor person's only possession. Now, naturally, the philosophy here is not to take the basics of life away from a helpless person as a promise for repayment of a loan. Compassion is not optional with our God. Compassion and mercy are integral. They're foundational of God's justice system. In fact, we are warned throughout the Bible that if we expect to be beneficiaries of Jehovah's compassion and forgiveness and mercy, we are to do likewise with our fellow man, especially the weakest among us. Now, by the way, please notice something pretty important here. This law applies to Hebrews lending money to other Hebrews. In other words, God's family lending within God's family. This does not apply by the letter of the law to those of God's family lending to outside the group. In fact, we even get a definition of an often asked question in Christianity: who is my neighbor? Here it is made clear that the neighbor is one of God's set-apart people. That is not to say that those in God's family are given license to treat those outside of God's family badly. Mercy is always called for. But God calls for special treatment and special priority for those who are living within the community of God. As much theological error as is contained within the Mormon community system, a lot could be learned from them about how to properly operate a community of God. Now, verse 27 and 28 needs to be looked at. If you have a King James Version, it probably says, "You shall not revile the gods." Strange. The word here for gods is Elohim, and it can mean gods, little g gods, in the plural. But that's so far out of the context that I'm pretty surprised that the excellent translators of the King James Version chose to translate it that way. There is a form of the Hebrew word Elohim that's called the plural of majesty. That's used when referring to God Almighty, the El, making the word El plural, you come up with Elohim. And often it does not mean more than one. It just indicates greatness. Hence the scholarly term for that use, the plural of majesty. Obviously, this verse is referring to Jehovah and Jehovah God alone, not little g gods. But then it goes on to say we're not to curse God, or in some texts, we're not to revile God. The Hebrew word used for curse here is kalal. It's exactly the same as when in Exodus 21, we are instructed not to curse, not to kalal our parents. As members of God's set-apart people, we're not to humiliate him. We're not to try him by our being of no account, to make him look bad by our incorrigible behavior and character. And this is different than how verse 27 ends when it also says not to curse a leader of your people. Here, curse is an entirely different Hebrew word, arar, which means curse more in the sense that we typically think of a curse. That is, no one is to swear a curse against their leader, either in the sense of invoking something magical or simply wishing them evil or harm, or swearing at them even in anger or bitterness. So in modern English, this verse basically says not to bring disrepute upon the Lord by our bad behavior. And next, not to issue a curse in order to cause evil to befall your tribal leader. Well, the final verses of Exodus 22 enjoin people to give to God their tithes and their offerings in a timely manner. We're not to hold our tithes back to our benefit and then give them at our convenience. Further, these people, Israel, who God in his grace has separated from the entire rest of the world, are not to eat meat as the heathens do, especially eat meat that has been killed by wild animals. God values animals. Make no mistake. But men are no more animal-like than God is simply a higher form of a human being. Therefore, God does not partake of what man partakes. And a man is not to partake of what animals partake. You with me on that? That's what it's explaining. Let's move on to Exodus chapter 23. We'll read the whole chapter. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're on page 86. You are not to repeat false rumors. Do not join hands with the wicked by offering perjured testimony. Do not follow the crowd when it does what is wrong. Don't allow the popular view to sway you into offering testimony for any cause if the effect will be to pervert justice. On the other hand, don't favor a perfect person's lawsuit simply because he is poor. If you come upon your enemy's ox or donkey straying, you must return it to him. If you see the donkey which belongs to someone who hates you, lying down helpless under its load, you're not to pass him by, but go and help him free it. Do not deny justice in his lawsuit simply because he's poor. Keep away from fraud. Do not cause the death of the innocent and the righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. You are not to receive a bribe, because a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the righteous. You are not to oppress a foreigner, for you know how a foreigner feels, since you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. For 6 years, you are to sow your land with seed, gather in its harvest, but in the seventh year, you're to let it rest, to lie fallow, so that the poor among you, poor among your people can eat. And what they leave, the wild animals in the countryside can eat. Do the same in your vineyard and olive grove. For 6 days, you're to work. On the seventh day, you are to rest, so that your ox and donkey can rest, and your slave girl's son and the foreigner can be renewed. Pay attention to everything I've said to you. Do not invoke the names of other gods, or even let them be heard crossing your lips. 3 times a year, you are to observe a festival for me. Keep the festival of matzah for 7 days, as I ordered you. You are to eat matzah at the time determined in the month of Aviv, for it was in that month that you left Egypt. No one is to appear before me empty-handed. Next, the festival of the harvest, the first fruits of your effort sowing the field. And last, the festival of ingathering, at the end of the year when you gather in from the fields the results of your efforts. 3 times a year, all your men are to appear before the Lord, Adonai. You're not to offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my festival to remain all night till morning. You are to bring the best first fruits of your land into the house of Adonai your God. You are not to boil a young animal in its mother's milk. I am sending an angel ahead of you to guard you on the way and bring you to the place I have prepared. Now pay attention to him. Listen to what he says. Do not rebel against him, because he will not forgive any wrongdoing of yours, since my name resides in him. But if you listen to what he says and do everything I tell you, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and a foe to your foes. When my angel goes ahead of you and brings you to the Amorites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, and Jebusites, I will make an end of them. You are not to worship their gods, serve them, or follow their practices. Rather, you are to demolish them completely and smash their standing stones to pieces. You are to serve Adonai your God. He will bless your food and water. I will take sickness away from among you. In your land, your women will not miscarry or be barren. You will live out the full span of your lives. I will send terror of me ahead of you, throwing into confusion all the people to whom you come. I will make all your enemies turn their backs on you. I will send hornets ahead of you to drive out the Hivites, Canaanites, and Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, which would cause the land to become desolate, the wild animals too many for you. I will drive them out from before you gradually until you have grown in number and you can take possession of the land. I will set your boundaries from the Sea of Suf to the Sea of the Philistines and from the desert to the Euphrates River, for I will hand the inhabitants of the land over to you. You will drive them out from before you. You are not to make a covenant with them or with their gods. They are not to live in your land. Otherwise, they will make you sin against me by ensnaring you to serve their gods. Now, we're going to receive a long series of laws here in a machine gun type fashion. They're going to come at us fast and furious. Now, most are quite easy to understand, so we're not going to examine every one of them in detail. We're going to merely read them like I've done, not bother to examine the ones that are self-explanatory. So we start with a series of laws that are very general in their nature in the first three verses of this chapter. The idea is that one is not to be untruthful, not to be partial or unjust. Generally speaking, these verses are referring to judicial integrity. That is, they are about the proper behavior for witnesses, judges, and the litigating parties. These verses are broad enough that they could have come right from a modern-day church sermon concerning right and wrong. Many of the rules we have encountered so far have been fully bound up in the context of ancient Hebrew culture. But these laws are more plain and contemporary and timeless. Their meaning is, do not be a party to false rumors. Don't help someone in validating a lie. Don't do wrong just because the majority thinks they want it. Don't allow what is popular to become what is right. Don't administer justice one way for a rich man and a different way for a poor man. Wow. I mean, in the season we are in right now, as we're but a couple of days from elections, think about what we just read. You know, from this pulpit, you do not hear politics. But I will tell you, pray and vote. This is your job. God has put the governing of this country into your hands. If you don't vote, you've said no thanks. It's that serious. Now, interestingly enough, it is the turning away from these very rules that are at the root of our declining societies all over the world. In modern terms, God is speaking against what? Political correctness, relativism, favoritism, Elitism, all the isms you can think of. Tolerance, appeasement, the denial of the existence of evil and of an end justifies the means mentality. Of course, these terms are the very definition of secular humanism, a political and social philosophy that's the pride of Europe and one that many in America are working hard to see adopted in this society. Secular human is the polar opposite of Judeo-Christianity. And that is the reason we see such political upheaval and cultural division in our society, especially in the society of the United States. The reality is, there is simply no middle ground between the godless and the godly. Even though government, synagogue, and church have all tried to navigate through these dangerous waters as though there is such a thing, that it is possible to find a middle ground if we just work hard enough at it and if we just display enough love. If we were to step back and be completely honest about it, we would have to admit that it is our human nature to follow the crowd and to not be different, to not be set apart from everybody else. If this wasn't the case, the Lord would not have found it necessary to tell us what he just told us, would he? This list of laws ensured something that especially the institutional church has frowned upon and fought against: division. Division. Church speaks against division all the time. The simple fact is, God creates his divine kind of unity by means of division and separation of humans. Now, it might sound like double talk. It's absolutely the truth. He sets up principles that are by their very nature choices. The minute you have a choice, you got to divide. Mankind is given a free choice to stand on one side or the other of that line. If he stands on the one side of God's principles, he has unity with God but conflict with humanity. If he stands on the other side of the line, he has unity with humanity but conflict with God. That's the way it is. The reason that Israel has always been a pariah to the world is that, generally speaking, they dedicated themselves to obeying Yehovah regardless of the consequences. They haven't always done a good job of it, but it sure automatically put them in conflict with the world. The reason that Christianity has steadily lost its power and standing as the moral authority on earth is that it has stopped being a pariah. Since the European Enlightenment of the 18th century, it seems that the goal of the church has been to make Christianity as close and attractive to the world as is possible, to camouflage itself as a friend of the world while still maintaining an aura of religiousness. The current era of the megachurch is simply the culmination of the Enlightenment philosophies. It's man's never-ending desire to never divide, but rather to try and find ways to unite through compromise. Compromise. Compromise and consensus have replaced unity. Majority rules has replaced God's rules. Tolerance has replaced our obligation to discern between good and evil, right and wrong. To say it out loud, that's the worst. Christ said, "Take up your cross and follow me." Translation, if you're not a pariah to the world and you don't find yourself being criticized and persecuted, maybe even a little bit for your stand, you're not doing what I told you to do. Well, starting in verse 4, we get some instructions that are usually credited to Yeshua as being the first to say them. These next verses are about the humane treatment of the enemy. Then we get another instruction often thought to be anti-Old Testament and occurring only in the New. It is to be merciful and to consciously help the poor. You see, Yeshua didn't come to abolish the ways of the Torah, God's ways. He was the most Torah-observant man in the history of the world. Every saying, listen to what I'm telling you, every saying of Christ came either verbatim or in principle and spirit directly from the Old Testament. In verse 9, God reminds Israel that they were at one time foreigners and under the cruel and unjust hand of a merciless dictator. And that perhaps the best example of how not to treat a foreigner that has come to live amongst Israel is how Israel was themselves being treated in Egypt. As we discussed before, God was laying the foundation for Gentiles, for Ger, to become part of Israel, not only in the physical sense, by literally becoming Hebrews, but also in the future spiritual sense that Yeshua's death on the cross would make possible. Gentile believers would join with Hebrew believers by faith, and together become the Israel of God, true spiritual Israel, if you would. At least that's what Paul calls it. Now, next in verses 10 through 12, we see the principle of the Sabbath applied in the practical, physical, earthly sense. In Genesis, we saw God set up the Sabbath principle of 6 days of work followed by 1 day of rest, or better, of ceasing normal activities and labors. God made the seventh day holy, not symbolically holy, literally holy. Yet Christ told his followers that the Sabbath was not made to benefit or to be used by God. Rather, God made the Sabbath for the benefit of humanity. Some theologians have tried to make this a conflict whereby we either choose the holiness of the true Sabbath as correct or the practical sense of it as a health benefit to mankind. Here we again run into the reality of duality. Every principle of God, his every instruction, his every action has an earthly physical side to it and a heavenly spiritual side to it. Shabbat was declared holy in a purely spiritual sense, yet it also served a very tangible physical purpose by being a day of rest and rejuvenation for all living creatures, not just humans. So in verses 10 through 12, we see the Sabbath principle is applied not just to days and weeks, but also to years. Notice that its benefits are applied to plants and even to the soil they grow in. Use the ground for 6 years, then let it have its Sabbath rest in the seventh. Well, next it's applied to animals. Work them for 6 days, let them rest the seventh day, so that your ox and donkey may cease, may rest. Then finally to people, and that includes foreigners, Gentiles, work 6 days, rest on the seventh to catch your breath. Now we've talked about the Sabbath before, and we're going to do so again occasionally, but here's one observation I'd like you to consider. The holiness of the seventh-day Sabbath is really only relevant to God's people. I know that's a bold statement, but I want to explain. There are two basic aspects to Shabbat. First, as a day of physical rest, and two, as a day of observance of a God-commanded holy day. The first is indeed about a physical benefit that we receive. The second is about the spiritual benefit that comes from simply being obedient to the Lord. Because of the way the Lord designed all things, humans, animals, plant, dirt, a regular rest helps all to physically rejuvenate. I can sign up for that. One can be an atheist and benefit wonderfully from resting one day in seven. But animals, plants, the dirt, and all humans who are not part of God's people are restricted only to the physical benefits of Shabbat. If one wants the spiritual benefit of Shabbat, the benefit that comes from observing the Lord's commandment to be holy as I am holy, then you have to be part of God's people. It's the only way you have that. So as believers who recognize the God-ordained benefit of resting one day in seven, you will be blessed from a physical standpoint no matter what day you choose to rest, just the same as would an atheist or a plow horse. But there's one day. There's only one day that brings a spiritual benefit that the Lord has ordained. And that is the particular day that the Lord has set apart as holy. The seventh day that formally is called Shabbat. Shabbat is not a day that we choose. It's a day the Lord chose long ago. It's not up for a vote. Verse 12 was the end of the first category of rules and regulations that God was setting up, those that involve human-to-human interaction. So from verse 13 to 20, the second category has begun, and Yehovah is now dealing with how humans are to relate to him. He starts by reiterating that other gods aren't going to be tolerated. Thus far in the Torah, Israel has been told not to make images of other gods, not to worship other gods. Now, not to even talk about, not to invoke the names of other gods. The ancient Hebrews were just like us. They were always looking for loopholes. Is it really an image of God if I have a statue or a painting of Christ? Really? Do I tithe on my income before or after taxes? Isn't worshiping God the same thing as my sitting watching someone else sing a Christian song on TV? Isn't my pastor praying for me the same thing as me praying? God was making about as clear as it can get that the Israelites were to have nothing to do or to say about other gods, period. And by the way, there's no loopholes on any of these things. Beginning in verse 14, the Hebrew religious calendar is set up. Yehovah ordains three pilgrimage festivals for Israel. In Leviticus, the festivals will be discussed in much more detail. Although eventually, God would set up seven feasts for Israel to celebrate, these three are special because the word pilgrimage, chag in Hebrew, suggests that the Israelites must journey to a specific place to celebrate these feasts. For now, out in the wilderness, They're simply told to present themselves before the Lord. Presumably that means assembling at the wilderness tabernacle that went with them wherever they went. Later on, after settling in the land of Canaan, they will be told to journey from wherever they might now live to Jerusalem, home of the temple, for these three out of the seven feasts. Now, like the instructions we just saw regarding the physical, earthly purposes of the Sabbath, we now see the physical, national purposes of the three pilgrimage feasts. Oh, look, they have an enormous spiritual element to them that we're not going to go into right now. But it's not the purpose of these particular instructions to teach about the spiritual, prophetic character of these three feasts. These are all about Jehovah ordaining an especially important set of three celebrations that sets Israel apart from all the other nations. It goes a long way in establishing a unique national identity for Israel that sets them apart as members of God's people on earth. Now, the three festivals are all agricultural based. Therefore, since spring is looked at typically as the beginning of the agricultural yearly cycle, the first festival is a springtime festival. And the first pilgrimage feast, called the Festival of Matzah, is also sometimes called Passover, but that's not technically correct, since Passover is a separate one-day feast. It is a time to celebrate, matzah is a time to celebrate God's deliverance of his people from slavery in Egypt. Now, the second pilgrimage feast, known as the Feast of Weeks, or in Hebrew, Shavuot, occurs 50 days following the Feast of Matzah, and it is to celebrate the second harvest of the year. This is the wheat harvest. The first harvest is of barley. Comes in a little earlier than the wheat. Christians have a different name for this holiday of Shavuot. We call it Pentecost. The third pilgrimage feast is the Feast of the Ingathering, also known as Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles. Sukkot's a fall season feast, and it represents the final ingathering, that is, the last of the harvest, is taken in before winter begins, and then fields go fallow. Now, by the time we reach Leviticus, Jehovah will have established precisely seven feasts. Every ancient culture had established feasts and days honoring their deities, usually centering on agricultural cycles. But the difference is that these seven feasts, beginning with the three we just discussed, are God-ordained. Now, sometimes in both the Old and the New Testaments, instead of the word feasts, we'll find the phrase appointed times to refer to these special holy days, which is certainly a correct translation. It captures the essence of God's appointed feast days. But as we study God's word, we have to be very careful to notice the difference between men's appointed times and God's appointed times. I think disregarding this difference has caused enormous confusion in Bible translation and in teaching. Some teachers have St. Paul declaring the end of the biblical feasts of appointed times, when in fact he is cautioning against observance of human, man-made feasts in appointed times, not God's. At other moments, he's telling his listeners that the rituals and procedures the rabbis have devised for some of the festivals were not representative of God. They're not from God. See, we must never think the New Testament at any point invalidates any of these holy days. I mean, after all, Yeshua himself participated in all the biblical feasts, and most of the recorded major events of his ministry occurred on one or another of these holy days. Yeshua died on Passover, was laid into the tomb on Matzah, was raised on First Fruits, and the Holy Spirit was sent on Shavuot. Now, the last half of verse 19 has a puzzling instruction that even the Hebrews have argued about for centuries. You're not to boil a young animal in its mother's milk. Because of this reason, you cannot buy a cheeseburger in Israel. As a tradition, you see, the Jews have enforced this by effecting a prohibition against serving or eating meat and dairy products at the same time. Depending on just how stringent a certain Jewish sect might be, one would either have to wash and purify the utensils that touched meat before those same utensils could touch dairy, or vice versa. Or, much more typically today, completely separate sets of utensils. Very typical in a Jewish home. And they don't have to be that religious. You can go in and you will find a separate set of utensils for meat and dairy, and if they're even more kosher, for Passover. Separate. Now, in some cases today, meat products and dairy products have to be kept in completely separate refrigerators. So those of you going to Israel, forget the cheeseburger. Unless you really want some serious frowns when you order it. And by the way, about the only place you can get one is to go to an Arab establishment. They'll happily serve you a cheeseburger. Now, the why of this law has generally been attributed to some kind of animal cruelty ritual that Yehovah was trying to avoid. I mean, let's face it, going out and milking a cow and then taking that cow's own calf and cooking it in that milk is a little tacky. But it's also thought that this might well have been a well-known custom of some pagan cultures during worship of some heathen deity. So God directly banned this practice by his people. Now, suddenly in verse 20, the tone of the chapter changes. And Yehovah moves from ordaining rules and regulations to making some promises to Israel. He says, you know, he's going to send an angel, a malach in Hebrew, to prepare the way for Israel's conquest of the land of Canaan. And that the people are to obey this angel. Because Yehovah says this particular angel carries his holy name. In other words, this angel either carries God's full authority, or, as is more often taught, this angel was a manifestation of God himself. Now, we could argue which of those views are correct till these cows come home. I don't think it's going to change much. The thing I want you to take from this is the inscrutable mystery that is our God. I've personally come to the conclusion that if I'm ever absolutely certain I can comprehend him, I've got it wrong. God will manifest himself however he decides to, whether it's as an angel, a cloud, a burning bush, whatever he wants. He spoke through a donkey once. The fact that we have a hard time squaring all that with the doctrine of the Trinity, whereby some church authorities have decided that every visible form of God has to be a form of Jesus, I doubt all this impresses the Lord all that much. And we shouldn't be too concerned about it either. Some things about God just are. And we just need to accept the mystery on faith and move on. In any case, Israel is to be unquestionably obedient to this particular angel. Not every angel, this one. And just as important as Israel begins to encounter people from this list of nations from verse 23, they're to avoid worshiping their gods. In fact, they're to destroy their idols, smash the various stone altars and monuments that they erected to their false deities. And if they'll do this, God will be an enemy to Israel's enemies. Doesn't sound a lot like tolerance. Doesn't sound too much like live and let live, does it? Yehovah tells Israel that if they will serve him, that he will make them very fruitful. He'll keep them from falling ill. He'll make them multiply very rapidly by keeping the Hebrew women from miscarrying. He will make the Hebrew population in general live out their full lifespans. Further, God is going to put terror into the hearts of Israel's enemies even before they arrive to Canaan. In other words, all these nations are going to have an irrational, supernatural fear of Israel that's going to cause them to run instead of standing and fighting. Of course, the hordes of the stinging hornets that the Lord is going to send against the various inhabitants of Canaan that might consider staying even in the face of that fear are going to be pretty painful. Another pretty good reason to get out of Israel's way. Now, verse 29 says something pretty interesting. God is going to lead Israel to such a swift victory in Canaan that it actually becomes necessary to slow them down. Can you imagine that? Therefore, he's not going to allow, he says, Israel to defeat Canaan in just a single year, even though it can be done. They're perfectly capable of doing it. Why not? Why wouldn't you want to get this over with in less than a year? Because, he says, if all the inhabitants of Canaan just flee at once, the land will go fallow for lack of care, and then wild animals are going to take over. So God is going to have Israel take over Canaan step by step at a rate that they can properly assume stewardship over the rich lands and resources they're about to acquire. And then in verse 31... we're told what the boundaries of the land that God is giving them is going to encompass. It's going to extend from the Gulf of Aqaba, which is a finger of the Red Sea to the east, to the domain of the Philistines, which is the Mediterranean Sea, on the west. The river to the north is the Euphrates. And the wilderness to the south is probably the Negev that borders on the Sinai Peninsula. Oh, this is a really big tract of land, which Israel has yet, by the way, to this day, ever to fully possess. Now, verse 32 speaks of not making a covenant with any of the Canaanite peoples. In other words, no peace treaties, no buying land, no appeasements of any kind. Why not? Verse 33 tells us that if Israel allows these various tribes of Canaan to remain, their mere presence will make you sin against me by ensnaring you to serve their gods. That's why. And as we're going to see in later studies, during the time when Joshua was leading Israel, in their human idea of mercy, Israel's leaders ignored God in this, and they did make treaties. And they did allow intermarriage, and they practiced tolerance, and Israel suffers from disobedience to this very day. Rather, this disobedience to this very day. I mean, it's a result of it. Where we stand today is because Joshua and his crew didn't listen. And while it might be difficult for us to swallow, the reality is that had Israel followed God's instructions 3,000 years ago and more, when invading Canaan, there would be no Middle East crisis today that never ends. What we have been witnessing since chapter 19 of Exodus is the making of a covenant, or in more precise biblical language, the cutting of a covenant. Now, chapter 24 is going to be all about the ratification of the covenant that's been spelled out now over the last several chapters. A covenant is far more than a contract. It's far more than a legal agreement between two parties. In the Bible, a covenant creates a binding together of those parties, a union of sorts. Some scholars have likened the covenant process here in Exodus as to a marriage. I would argue with that somewhat, but yet the union element of a covenant indeed reminds one, to a degree, of the union which occurs in human marriage. In Exodus 19 through 23, we have seen the terms of the covenant between Israel and God being laid out. And by the way, the style of its structure that we've seen very much resembles ancient Middle Eastern treaties and pacts between people and nations, particularly those treaties of the more highly developed cultures, such as that of the Hittites. Now, archaeologists and papyrologists are people who study ancient documents from the standpoint of both writing methods and content to kind of help determine when a particular document was written, who wrote it, what body of literature it might belong to. They have a wealth of written treaties and covenants from ancient times to compare with biblical covenants. There's no shortage of them. And while there are many similarities which enable us to be certain of the era that the covenant of Moses occurred, which is 1300 to 1400 BC by our calendars, somewhere in there, there are some glaring differences between those treaties and the Mosaic covenant written at Mount Sinai. Now, first of all, no covenant ever discovered from any ancient culture was in effect a written agreement between a man and a god. Second, every document ever found that comprised what we might term a law code, such as the Code of Hammurabi, separated the people into classes with varying degrees of privilege and deference to the rich and the royal over the general population, then the poor, then, of course, the slave class. Third of all, these law codes tended to make religious ritual and regulation separate from the civil law, with religious law having little or no effect upon civil law. Religion was compartmentalized. It was made into its own little world, if you would. And then it was used only when people dealt with their gods. Obviously, the covenant of Moses was a complete departure from these law systems. God himself was the covenant partner with the people of Israel. God did not ordain a class structure of people. He actually sought to begin to destroy the lines between slave and free men. He even made religion and civil law one in the same, inseparable. That is, all justice, all mishpat, comes from Jehovah God. All of it. So the covenant of Moses was quite unique. It was even a departure from the previous covenants that God had made with Noah and then with Abraham. Because in both cases of those much earlier covenants, they were just one-sided promises. And in both cases, the promises were God's promises. The covenants of Noah and Abraham were unilateral. The covenant of Moses was bilateral. That is, both sides have obligations and responsibilities. The covenants of Noah and Abraham were unconditional. Nothing man could do could cause God to retract his promises. The covenant of Moses was conditional. The people of Israel had to follow through with their end of the deal. The terms of the covenant, or a variety of disciplinary actions, even temporary withdrawal of certain blessings by God would occur. And they did. Now, one final point. Law codes in those ancient days, as now, tend to be very formal, cold, legalistic in their structure. Unquestioned obedience without necessarily even understanding the reason for a particular law was required. Now, although it might not have occurred to you, the way that the laws of God were given to the people of Israel was full of warmth and rich with symbolism. And God's laws were given with much narration, a lot of explanation. Why? Because it is the principles and the spirit of the law which God is teaching, which is important. The purpose of the law, as with all the Torah, was to teach. In fact, the word Torah means teaching or instruction. And while many of the details of the Mosaic Law are Hebrew in their cultural context, the principles behind every one of these laws are timeless. The principles are applicable to all human beings in every culture. In these laws, Jehovah has expressed the basics of the way his universe operates. We trespass upon these principles at our own risk. Well, next week, we're going to examine Exodus chapter 24. And in it, we'll see just how this covenant between God and Israel was formally ratified.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.